Dungeons & Dragons, using the lens of science. I'm Justin Frazee.
And I'm Dr. Betsy Schock.
And today we're talking about being big.
Yes, so we were a little bit bummed that we didn't get to do our Monster of the Month feature for January. So we decided to make up for it by talking about three monsters this week. And as Justin alluded to, the theme is big. Not just big, gargantuan.
The biggest. So we picked some of our favorites, and you'll have to stick around to figure out which ones those were.
Yes. So before we talk about these monsters specifically, what are some general challenges to being a large animal? So there aren't a ton of large animals out there. I think probably the same ones come to mind when we think about them, probably elephant, mm-hmm. the largest for land animals in current day, and then blue whale, obviously, for largest sea animal.
Right. So the issue comes with the square cube law, which basically means that as something grows, its surface area goes up by being squared, but its volume gets cubed. So if you imagine just a simple cube, as you scale it up, if you measured all the outsides of it, you know, you would multiply it by itself once as you scaled it up, but the interior volume would go up. You would multiply it by itself three times. So cubed. Which just means that the weight of things quickly outgrows its surface area, and you start having issues from that weight to surface area proportion. You have to carry larger and larger amounts of weight and compensate that for like larger and larger bones, and like you have problems with like blood and pumping blood, all of that. So like, for example, a giraffe, which is very tall mammal, has to have special valves which will allow the blood not to go back down. It can like only get pushed in one direction towards its head. Otherwise, its brain wouldn't get enough blood.
Yeah, that makes sense. I was also thinking like one of the problems of being large is you need to consume a lot of food. Mm-hmm. Especially if you are a warm-blooded creature, you just need to consume more calories than a cold-blooded counterpart would. And basically, like, there becomes challenges with the amount of calories you need just to, like, sustain your body temperature relative, like, to how much you can eat. And, like, the act of eating and digesting is going to burn those calories, which means you have to eat more to compensate for the fact that you're eating.
Mm-hmm. So the first one we're going to tackle is the rock, which when you go through the monster manual, you just see a bird and you're like, oh, that's neat. And I didn't really start to really think the rock was special until I realized just how large it is, which we can read, but the wingspan can be up to 200 feet. That's a big bird.
That's, yeah, a very big bird. And yeah, it's pictured across the monster's manual from a roper, which is also a large creature. But like, I don't know, the way they have it on the page doesn't make it seem like it's anything different than a normal bird, but it's classified as gargantuan.
Yeah. It's hard to really grasp how large it is just by seeing an out of context image, but let's read an excerpt.
At first sight, a rock silhouette looks much like any other bird of prey. As it descends, however, its unearthly size becomes terrifyingly clear. In flight, a rock's wingspan spreads 200 feet or more. At rest, perched upon the mountain peaks that are its home, this monstrous bird rivals the oldest dragons in size.
So the book goes on to talk about the origin of these massive birds, which is a giant god created them to rival the power of dragons in their wars. And it goes on to say, like, after that, they even hunt things like giants, whales, elephants. Like, they are looking for large prey. And that kind of talks to what you were saying, that, like, they need to eat a lot.
Yeah. It also mentions that their eggs, which they don't have a lot of, but they are taller than a human. So I can... I don't know. I just think about like the amount of yolk and stuff in there and like basically like the raw calories. Like that could probably feed a village for like a week or something like that.
Yeah. So, of course, the problem of flight comes up. Now, With something like dragons, in D&D, dragons are inherently magical, so you can justify their flight as being based in magic. But as far as we can see, rocks don't have any sort of magical attacks or magical traits, so they're just physical beings.
Yeah, their attack is pretty standard, just attack with like the talons. So yeah, versus when you start reading more into the lore of dragons, you very clearly see that they have some magical properties.
So how can something so large fly? Now, if you're not familiar, you have this square cube law problem where a creature so large would need larger and larger proportional wings to be able to lift its weight. And then from there, you have this issue of like, if the wing is so much larger, then you need these huge muscles to be able to move those wings. And then for that, you need these bones that can sustain these huge amounts of pressure that you're putting on them from these muscles. And the way things fly is being very light, like bones from birds are hollow. Birds, other flying things like bats, are just built very light. So it's very difficult for a very, very large creature like this to be able to fly, because you'd have to have denser bones for larger wings and larger muscles, which just makes the whole thing heavier.
So I guess from that, we can at least establish that the physical composition of rocks is different. Like the biology is different than typical avians here. Because from what you're describing, this isn't possible.
Yeah, like you couldn't have a traditional animal that was constructed of traditional bone material, traditional muscle material, and have it this large and fly. So something special has to be going on. Now, the question is, what is that?
Yeah, so let's actually start with the bones. I feel like that's a good place to start. What would be strong enough but light enough in terms of material?
So there's not really anything, if we take this example into like our world, there's planes out there that are about this size, like the 747, you know, they can hold a tremendous amount of weight. The thing is they get a lot more lift by having these huge engines that create a bunch of thrust. And you don't have the problem of needing to flap their wings. And like, that's how birds, you know, achieve thrust, is by manually flapping their wings. They don't have engines. So yeah, you do have a problem with like, let's start with the bones, because if imagine everything else being the same of like, if they have these huge muscles, they need to not be able to snap their bones. Well, if you take something like aluminum, which is what aircraft are made out of, it's too soft. It's going to bend. And it's not going to go back to its shape. It's just going to bend and crumple, and you're not going to be able to sustain itself.
Yeah, so we don't want that in a bird.
Right. Now, if you pick something stronger like steel, it's significantly heavier. And you might be thinking like, oh, what about something like titanium? So titanium is actually pretty similar to aluminum, where, you know, it does have this great strength to weight ratio, but it's relatively soft and would bend like aluminum. So you would really want something like steel, but steel is far too heavy. It would be too much weight. You couldn't get off the ground. So fortunately, So we can think about, okay, this is a creature specifically made by a god to be large, huge, be able to counter dragons. So gods have access to a tremendous amount of power. And in the world of D&D, there are different materials than in our world. Something like mithril could work in this sort of application, where it is this tremendously strong material that is also super light, something that doesn't exist in our world. So somehow, maybe the bones are made of something like mithril, which isn't an organic material.
Yeah, the biologist in me was like, I wonder how this would work.
But it's, you know, perhaps part of its system is being able to digest mithril, and maybe part of its diet is like consuming mithril. Now, we consume like iron and like trace minerals like that, and that goes into, you know, what our body builds in different cells, like blood cells. But perhaps, you know, like something like an ostrich, you know, consumes rocks to be able to break up its food. So it's not out of the question for a bird to deliberately eat a crazy substance like that. No, obviously ostriches aren't like actually digesting their food, although the rocks do get polished. And there are cases of diamonds being found in ostriches. So like a tremendously special hard material like that has actually been found in real birds. So perhaps the rocks were created in a way that part of their diet is consuming these crazy materials like mithril. And then they are in, like able to digest it, even if it takes a long time, perhaps. And then that is able to, you know, make its way and like construct cells and, you know, structures made out of these super materials.
So I guess I don't know in D&D lore, but Lord of the Rings, mithril is associated with the dwarves, therefore it's underground. So how are these birds eating it in the first place?
Good question. So I guess I would come back to this, the same ostrich example is normally you would find something like diamonds in a mining situation, but somehow these ostriches were attracted to this stone that they found, probably, you know, part in one where they consume stones for this digestion purpose and partly because it was shiny. I would assume that like rocks live in the mountains or they at least they dwell there predominantly. It's possible that they're able to find these special minerals in the exposed parts of cliffs or that sort of thing and able to pull them out.
I guess I was also thinking about this in terms of baby rocks hatching. Like it might be interesting if like basically mama rocks are feeding baby rocks mithril rocks. And because if you think about an adult rock, you're going to need a lot of mithril to basically be able to build that bone structure. But if you're starting with something smaller and it's able just to kind of integrate in passively and be maintained throughout their life, then that seems a little bit more feasible.
Yeah. It's also, you could imagine that like younger rocks wouldn't necessarily need it, you know, until they've start getting, you know, very large. There is some examples of real organic creatures getting very large in our world and still being able to fly. But, you know, not that large. I think the largest one, forget the name of it, it's a type of pterodactyl basically that got up to a 30-foot wingspan, which is very large, not 200 feet. But, you know, you could imagine a, you know, a rock being able to sustain itself up until adolescence without needing, you know, mithril bones. So being able to have that time to like maybe build up a store of it to use as it grew.
Yeah, that makes sense. So we've been talking about bones. What about muscles? Do we think there needs to be anything special about the muscles to be able to generate the force needed to get them in the air, essentially?
I mean, anything that's going to lend itself to being strong but lighter is going to help. Because the lighter the muscles can be, the lighter, you know, everything can be, the easier it's going to be to get this thing off the ground. So you know, you apply some of the same ideas where there are some special materials that are the muscles are made out of that make them as strong or stronger, but lighter. And so they're able to apply these tremendous forces to be able to move their wings, but, you know, be lighter and be able to get off the ground. And I would imagine like their flight would look different. Like they probably need a running start or need to jump off like a cliff. It'd be very difficult for them to like just get like from a standstill up to the ground because they need that additional push.
Yeah, I was actually imagining them kind of taking advantage of having their nest in the mountains and kind of just doing like a running jump. Mm-hmm. And hopefully there'd be some currents up that high that would help get them up.
Yeah, I definitely think that would be part of their natural flight is like making use of those strong air currents next to mountains.
Cool. So rock, not possible in our world.
Right.
But D&D, we can make it work.
It's a fantasy world. It's got some magic and this thing was made directly by a god. So why not?
Yeah. All right. So let's move on to our next very, very large creature. Instead of talking about the skies, let's move to the sea. And so our gargantuan creature that we're going to be switching to is the Kraken.
Unleash the Kraken.
Yes. which Kraken is seen in a lot of different lore. So I feel like it gets presented in a lot of different ways. So it's worth describing in a little bit more detail what the D&D Kraken is specifically.
Mm-hmm.
So one feature that I think is worth pointing out before we get into the description more is that the D&D Kraken is amphibious. So it can breathe both air and water, which I think is different than a lot of portrayals of Krakens in other lores, essentially.
Mm-hmm. So the book reads, "Beneath the waves, the Kraken sleeps for untold ages, awaiting some fell sign or calling. Land-born mortals who sail the open sea forget the reasons their ancestors dreaded the ocean. Even as the races of the deep ignore strange gaps in their histories when their civilizations nearly vanished at the appearance of the tentacled horror." So its appearance is kind of unique when compared to those other depictions you've talked about. A lot of times when I think of a Kraken, I think of Pirates of the Caribbean where it was kind of squid-like or octopus-like. But this is got those amphibian features that you talked about, or, you know, other sort of features. Like its face and head kind of reminds me of a lizard.
Yeah, the head itself has kind of like lizard or like horn spikes on it that are like some underlying structure is kind of making their shape. It has teeth, like more like a piranha. And the limbs are kind of unique. I would say they're almost turtle-like. But then I guess coming off the back, it's hard to see from this photo, are those tentacle protrusions that are more classic of what you think of with the Kraken.
Yeah, but it does have this like really elongated body, kind of like an eel.
Yeah.
I just realized there's great white sharks off the front of it that give us some sort of scale context. They're maybe as big as one of its tooth.
I honestly just thought those were normal fish, not sharks. So you're probably right. That actually makes a lot of sense.
So when it comes to large creatures in the Monster Manual, the Kraken is maybe one of the most feasible ones. You have this advantage when you're in the water where the squared cube law, it's not as a big of effect. You don't have to bear such a great weight because the water is, you know, bearing that weight for you. And you have the additive, you know, pressure of the water that's keeping, you know, compared to air, water has a tremendously more pressure, so it can help kind of keep your body together.
Yeah. So with like blue whales, for example, like the water buoyancy helps to support their bodies and take strain off their muscles and skeletons. And there are some scientists out there that actually think that blue whales could get actually a lot larger than their current size. And that's basically limited by having a short gestational period of just 11 months. So basically, if they're fetal stages, they're allowed to get bigger, they could grow to be even longer and larger.
Which is why in general, because of those reasons, you can see that the largest sea creatures are much, much larger than any sort of large land creatures in our world.
Also, if a Kraken is amphibious, that should mean that it is cold-blooded. So it doesn't need to maintain a specific temperature. Like its body is not trying to regulate that temperature. It just needs to stay within a temperature where it can survive. So basically, it's going to have lower metabolic requirements mm-hmm. compared to warm-blooded counterparts. I'm sure it still needs to eat a lot, but that probably helps some.
It also seems like from that first paragraph that it hibernates a lot of the time, and maybe it only has short periods of activity between its hibernations.
One thing we also learned that is different from the rock is Krakens, I think, most likely are magical. They're able to create a lightning storm, and it specifies that this is a magical effect. The Kraken magically creates three bolts of lightning, each which can strike a target the Kraken can see within 120 feet of it. So once you throw magic into the picture, I think you're a little bit less limited, or your physical constraints, you maybe don't have to quite worry about as much.
Right. I mean, I still think we would run into some of the same things of like, this is still a very, very, very large creature. And I think you would still run into the same issues And you solve some of those issues, like some of the energy issues, like what you were talking about, where it's probably cold-blooded, it probably hibernates for a long period of time and only has short periods of activity. So it doesn't need to be like consuming all the time. You would probably devastate like the ocean if it had to, you know, be active all the time. But you still run into some of the same size issues. So we could probably guess that it's either sustained like size-wise through some sort of magic or special material, again, because it is so enormous.
I wonder, it doesn't, you can't really see it from the picture, but I wonder if it just has like passive like filter feeder spots on its body. Like, I mean, its mouth is pretty decked out with teeth, but maybe there are other ways where it can kind of just constantly filter feed on detritus or whatever else is swimming around. Or at that point, like probably fish will just get, small fish will get stuck up in it.
Or not so small fish.
Yeah. So one thing that I thought was really cool about the Kraken is the lightning ability, which is magical in nature, but I like to think about it like the ocean is probably salt water. I guess I don't know that for sure in D&D. Or is it all just fresh water?
I would imagine. I've never thought about it before, but I would guess it would salt water, yeah.
And I'm, okay, so with that, I'm reminded, I don't know if anyone read 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea by Jules Verne, but...
some people have, I would imagine.
Okay. Anyone who's listening. So the ship that they're in, the Nautilus, I haven't read this since like I was in fourth or fifth grade, but I was really struck with like this idea of harnessing the salt in the ocean to be able to make energy to power the ship. Do you remember this at all?
No, but that reminds me of cold fusion.
Okay. Anyway, I'm wondering if like the electrical abilities are basically tied to using the salt somehow. And maybe that's just me, like, wanting that to be real from 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Yeah, that would be neat if it had some sort of internal...
I mean, basically the idea with the salt is like it's an ion. So you're able to make this like ion gradient, which would be like the same thing as like how our nerve cells fire is by creating these action potentials through ion gradients, basically inside and outside the cell.
I suppose like if it's able to create a significant enough charge, it could... it would attract lightning in an area from the sky. I mean, obviously creating a storm with all of its effects would be, you know, addition to that, but.
Well, I think even the layer effect is the layer itself is like electrified, for like lack of a more precise word. Yeah, it says that the water in the Kraken's layer becomes electrically charged.
And they have to make a 23 DC constitution saving throw or take 3d6 lightning damage.
Could be worse.
Your damage could be worse, but no one's passing that constitution. Yeah. Well, some people might, but.
So there is one other feature of the Kraken that I want to talk about. And it's that they can travel between freshwater and saltwater, which is something that not all sea creatures can do. So I think probably a common example most people are familiar with are salmon are able to travel from saltwater to freshwater, and they do their mating in the freshwater streams. And so we read up a little bit on what allows these fish and other types of fish to be able to live in these two environments. And it basically comes down to osmoregulation, which is how your cells deal with water and salt content. There's basically like two different methods for this. So one that primarily saltwater fish use, and then a separate method that freshwater fish use. And the ones that are able to live in both environments are actually able to cellularly switch which one they're using, depending on what type of water they're in, which is pretty cool. So the book like mentions, and this is actually, I think, pretty terrifying, that like the Krakens will go up the river to like nest, and they'll just destroy towns along the way, like willy-nilly, no big deal. But one thing that's different about the Kraken and the fish is that the fish are fish and the Kraken is an amphibian. And so there are some inherent differences with that. Fish breathe through their gills. Amphibians typically breathe through their skin. So that's different. And actually, there's not really any saltwater amphibians. Like, amphibians that primarily live in salt water. Most of them are freshwater, and there are a few amphibians that are actually like saltwater tolerant. The species that I actually work with in lab, so I work with frogs, their scientific name is Xenopus laevis, and they are actually one of the species that is saltwater tolerant. So if we are, not that anyone really cares what I do, but I take female frogs and I squeeze out their eggs, and then I take their eggs and I fertilize them with dissected out male testes. So that's science for you guys. But there another way that we can collect these is we'll actually put the females in a high salt solution. And the eggs will just stay in there unless the females decide to eat them, which happens. And we can suck them out and then fertilize them. And keeping them out in the high salt water actually kind of preserves the eggs and keeps them from triggering like fake fertilization prematurely. Is that related to the Kraken? Probably not. But now you guys know. So
maybe salt water aids in its hibernation somehow.
Yeah. But I at least think that the Kraken has some unique cellular abilities to be able to live in both of these environments,
yeah.
which is kind of cool.
That is neat. So we've done air and sea, on to land. Well, on land, what could be bigger and scarier than the Tarrasque?
That's true. So this is your challenge rating 30. This is as big and as bad as it gets in D&D.
It literally says the Tarrasque is possibly the most dreaded monster of the material plane.
That leaves the question of what's on those other planes that's scarier.
Who knows?
Who knows? We're not going into that today or ever, maybe. I don't know. We'll see. If you want to ask us, dig into that question, send us an email.
So it goes on to say, it is widely believed that only one of these creatures exists, though no one can predict where and when it will strike. A scaly biped, the Tarrasque is 50 feet tall and 70 feet long, weighing hundreds of tons. It carries itself like a bird of prey, leaning forward and using its powerful lashing tail for balance. Its carnivorous maw yawns wide enough to swallow all but the largest creatures, and so great is its hunger that it can devour the populations of whole towns. I mean, this is basically D&D's Godzilla.
Yeah, more or less. The thing from this that strikes me is, like, if it's this big, like, how do you not know where it is at all times?
If it's anything like Godzilla, Godzilla lives, like, in the sea and then emerges. So it could be something like that.
But then it's not our land monster.
But, I mean, it doesn't, when it attacks, it comes out to land. I don't know.
Maybe it, like, is able to sit still for a while and people just think it's a mountain.
I mean, yeah, if it's there for long enough, it would just get covered, I would assume. And then, oh, it says here, legends tell how the Tarrasque slumbers in its secret lair beneath the earth, remaining in a dormant state for decades or centuries. When it awakens in answer to some inscrutable cosmic call, it rises from the depths to obliterate everything in its path. So there we go. It hides in the earth like a mole.
So this is big, like really big.
And really, really heavy.
Yeah. So like, let's put it in perspective, like elephants.
Okay.
So the African elephants have been known to reach heights of 13 feet tall and weigh up to 7.5 tons. So that is teeny tiny compared to this bad boy. I think dinosaurs, they like have predicted that from some of the bones that there was a Titanosaurus that weighed in nearly at 80 tons. And so that's kind of getting more on this scale.
Yeah. 80 tons is pretty big, but this is just far exceeds that in hundreds of tons.
So one quick question before we get to that. Magical, non-magical?
That's a good question.
So it has listed that it has, okay, magic resistance. So there we go. We have our answer. It's magical. You'd have to be magical to be magic resistant.
Not necessarily. You could imagine that some materials would have resistance to just fire or lightning or that sort of thing. So maybe I would imagine it's just possibly super tough.
And magic missile doesn't necessarily hit.
Interesting. I mean, it's possible that it has magic. It doesn't have any sort of magical powers other than magical resistance.
That's true. And I with this, it could just be like, because it's so large, it's like has a really thick, like I'm going to call it a hide for lack of a better term.
Yeah. So this, of course, has the same problem with the rock, but possibly amplified. I mean, it doesn't have to fly. So that's a benefit. But it weighs so much. It would put so much strain on these two legs. It goes two-legged. So it doesn't even have the advantage of something like an elephant that could have 4 points of support. It's two-legged. So there was a dinosaur called the Spinosaurus that was very large. It was, you know, from 41 to 59 feet long and weighed 20 metric tons. It seems like it was a lot slimmer, though, smaller. Like, it was pretty close in length, but, you know, pretty thin itself, weighing much less. So, you know, it's similar. You know, you can imagine something this large. You maybe, because it doesn't have to fly, it doesn't have quite as many problems, but it's still very, very weighty. And, like, supporting hundreds of tons of material on two legs is very difficult. And I would have to imagine something special is going on there, something more than just traditional bone structure.
Yeah, I actually don't really know much about dinosaurs to know, like, cellularly, if there's anything different about their bone composition from other reptiles, that would lend itself better to basically being in that bipedal state with all that extra weight.
So it looks like the Spinosaurus's legs had, or at least the bones, had osteosclerosis, which is high bone density, which probably helped support its weight. And this would, at minimum, have that, if not having some of the same properties, perhaps, as a rock of consuming materials. Now, if it was something like the rock and it could consume minerals to help support itself, its options would be wider. You wouldn't have to have such a specialized material like mithril. You could, you know, perhaps iron or other more basic, more mundane materials could be used, because you don't have to have as much of a lightweight nature to, you know, assist in flight.
Yeah, that makes sense. So if it's like hibernating under the earth, I feel like it could just like pop a quick snack of some rocks or something before it heads up. And also the fact that it hibernates for so long is really interesting, especially with such a large size. So I feel like when we think of creatures that are able to go a very long time without any sort of food, we often think of like small creatures like tardigrades that are able to survive the craziest conditions. But these are teeny tiny microscopic creatures. So something like this, there definitely must be something different with its metabolism.
Yeah, I mean, we do see larger creatures that have limited periods of hibernation, like bears or such, but it's not for such long periods of time. So yeah, you would imagine there's something going on that's like slowing the metabolism or stopping it entirely, like preserving this creature, allowing it to be in stasis basically for decades, eons, you know.
And I know we talked about these, or at least they could be magical, but from the description, maybe they're not. But if they're responding to a cosmic call, maybe the gods are involved somehow in basically putting it in this state and then bringing it out of that state when needed.
Yeah, that's entirely possible. So who would win in a fight? Three-way fight. Who would win? Who are you betting on?
Where's the fight happening?
Oh, yeah, favorite terrain. That's a good question. Because, like, they definitely have an advantage on whatever their territory is.
Yeah.
But maybe it's like a round-based system where they have to fight one. Well, no one's getting into the air besides a rock. So just land or sea. I don't know. I would imagine the rock and the Tarrasque isn't going to survive underwater for a very long period of time. I would imagine the Tarrasque would just sink, would have a very hard time in the water.
Well, especially if its bones are heavier.
Yeah. I mean, it's hundreds of tons. And in comparison to its buoyancy, not very great.
Yeah. The Kraken is pretty versatile. With it, is an amphibian, so it can do land or sea. And if it has a location, it can kind of like play on both of those, where it like baits them towards the sea to play towards that advantage.
Yeah, I think in a direct fight, the Tarrasque is going to beat the other two. It's just like, it's so dense. Its hide is so tough. It's so resilient to damage that it's going to win a knockout fight. But both of the other creatures, the Rock and the Kraken, can get away from it, like either through flight or, you know, swimming. They can go places that the Tarrasque just can't.
Can we look at their intelligence scores?
Sure.
I'm curious, like, which would maybe be smartest? Okay, Rock, we got a -4 intelligence.
That's bad.
Kraken, +6. I don't know. I'm leaning towards the Kraken. Tarrasque, -4. I think I'm throwing in the Kraken here. I think it would be smart enough to figure it out.
Yeah, if the Kraken could drag the Tarrasque into the water, that's game over.
Yeah.
It wouldn't need to pierce the armor. It would just need to suffocate it. And it's far and above the most intelligent thing. So, like, so raw scores, a Rock has 3 intelligence, a Tarrasque has 3 as well, but the Kraken has 22. That is a creature that is more intelligent than most beings out there. Most adventurers, most sages.
Yeah.
And, you know, when it comes to strategy, intelligence always wins. So I think you might be right. I think in a brawl, Tarrasque comes out, but you get a Kraken that's, you know, in water and maybe like on a beach sort of area. If it can manage to pry the Tarrasque into the water, and I think it's smart enough to do that, that's game over.
Yeah, and if it can get it kind of like a layer effect with some electricity going, that is not one of its immunities.
It's also statistically as strong. So the strength is matched. And yeah, I guess I'm betting on the Kraken. That changed my mind. I'm going with the Kraken.
All right. So 2 votes for Kraken here. If you guys have opinions or thoughts on who would win on this 3-way brawl.
Or another creature that would stand a fight.
Yeah. Maybe at some point we'll put out like a creature bracket or something like that and see you guys vote on that, chat about it. But anyway, if you have any thoughts on that, please send us an email at scienceofdd@gmail.com.
Yeah, and thanks for listening, guys. See you later.